You turn to Marketplace for the latest news about what's happening in the economy and how it impacts you and your community. When you donate to support our nonprofit newsroom, you can also get something a little more tangible. We've got a great lineup of donor thank you gifts right now, a shrinkflation mini tote bag, water bottles, mugs, hats, and yes, the Kai PA glasses are back, but only while supplies last, and I'm taking some of them. Contribute any amount to make a difference and pick up one of these gifts. Go to marketplace.org/donate. In this order today, we've got immigration infrastructure, how to run the National Security Council, given everything, and coal mining jobs across the generations. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday, the 21st day of February. Good as always to have you here, everybody. In a word, the new guidance from the Department of Homeland Security on immigration enforcement that came out this morning boils down to more. More agents, more detention capacity, and more deportations. There is a part of this story where immigrants' rights communities and perhaps others wind up in court against the administration. But right now, it's an infrastructure story, a government operation with a questionable ability to handle the kind of growth that is being called for. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams gets us going from Washington.
For the Trump administration to go ahead with this plan, the U.S. needs more agents. 5,000 for Border Patrol, 10,000 for Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Sean Moran is with the National Border Patrol Council, a union that backed Trump in the campaign. He says Border Patrol is already struggling to fill more than 1,500 jobs.
So we really need to ramp up the hiring process to get them into the training pipeline so that we can start doing that.
The DHS plan also calls for expanding a program that trains local law enforcement to help federal agents. Randy Capps is with the Migration Policy Institute.
And that would mean more places around the country where local officers were assisting federal officers in enforcing immigration laws.
Once people are detained, they have to go to court before being deported. And there's a shortage there, too, says Dana Lee Marks, president of the National Association of Immigration Judges.
At the present time, there's approximately 300 immigration judges in field courts around the country. And we have over 540,000 pending cases.
Plus, the DHS plan calls for expanded detention capabilities. Royce Murray is with the National Immigrant Justice Center. She says detention centers already cost $2 billion a year.
Not to mention the fact that ICE is already operating over capacity at 41,000 detention beds right now, with the memos instructing ICE to bring on thousands of additional beds.
She points out some of the fiscal conservatives in Congress may not be on board to foot that bill. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
There were a couple of stories in the Wall Street Journal over the weekend that have economists and economic journalists, to be honest, saying, wait, what? The gist of it is that the White House is thinking about changing the way the trade deficit is calculated and, in a separate piece, is telling government economists what economic growth rate they ought to gear their analysis toward hitting. The skeptical way of looking at that is that the numbers are being manipulated for political reasons. The party line way of looking at it is that the agencies at the center of the controversy say nothing has been decided yet and that any changes are meant only to improve the accuracy of the numbers. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Ganser looked into it.
Economists generally aren't a very excitable bunch, but mess with numbers and they get upset.
Oh, it is cooking the books. It verges on fraud.
That's Don Boudreau. He teaches economics at George Mason University. He says the Trump administration is asking the Commerce Department's Bureau of Economic Analysis, which issues trade deficit figures, to change how we count products that just cross into the U.S. briefly on their way to another country. Right now, they're counted as imports and exports. Boudreau says the White House just wants to count them as imports to help sell a renegotiation of NAFTA or higher taxes on imports.
To count them as imports and not count them as exports, that artificially inflates the trade deficit figure, which is the goal.
But the Commerce Department says, hey, we're just thinking about doing this to be as precise as possible. Edward Alden is with the Council on Foreign Relations. He says commerce should think twice.
If they're going to change it, I would like to see a really compelling rationale, and I haven't seen that yet.
The White House might also change the way it measures economic growth, issuing unrealistically rosy forecasts. According to Stan Collender, a budget guru at MSL Group, he says the administration could use these numbers to persuade Congress to back its spending plans.
This would be the way to curry favor, get the votes they want.
Collender says other presidents have used overly optimistic forecasts to justify their spending, but not to this extent. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Uber has a public relations crisis on its hands, one that has nothing to do with the company's CEO being on and then quitting President Trump's business advisory panel, or with the charges of strike breaking in New York that the weekend of the immigration executive order came out. This weekend, a former employee alleged systemic sexual harassment at the company and virtually no response from management. Uber has promised an urgent investigation, but for a company that can be boycotted just by deleting an app on your phone, reputation is key, as Marketplace's Andy Euler reports.
Uber CEO Travis Kalanick told employees in a memo on Monday that Holder's investigation would look into claims of sexual harassment, but also into diversity and inclusion at Uber more broadly. Eric Lin is executive director at the brand consulting firm Siegel & Gale. He says this PR crisis is different from Uber's previous ones.
Most of their crises in the past have been externally facing. Really aggressive business practices, perceived mistreatment of drivers. This is new in a sense that this is for the first time unveiling an issue that lives within the walls of Uber as an organization.
When you're a startup and the only game in town, a good reputation isn't nearly as important as ease of use and convenience. But for Uber, now there's competition. Jonathan Bernstein is president of Bernstein Crisis Management. He says the cost of moving over to Lyft for your ride sharing is basically nothing.
Deleting an app, Uber app or anything else, it takes 2 seconds. And as a consumer who has used both services, I don't care a lot which one I use, except for if one of them, this thing going on and that thing going on, well, I'm going to choose the one that's more socially responsible.
And it appears Uber gets that. Felicia Miller teaches management at Marquette University. She says being a company in today's environment of nearly total transparency is different than it was before Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. So Uber had to do something.
Particularly newer, nimble, services-oriented companies are much quicker to respond because they're much closer to their consumers.
But the competition can reach out to consumers just as quickly. She says she wouldn't be surprised to see a reaction from Lyft as this investigation plays out. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, what's not to like, huh? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. So here's the organizational behavior question of the day. You take over a shop that's become the center of a whole lot of not great news the past 6, maybe 8 weeks. How do you go about righting the ship and getting people back to work? Such is the challenge the new National Security Advisor, Lieutenant General H.R. McMaster, faces. He got the job, as you know, yesterday. We have called Dr. Erin Simpson to talk about the task General McMaster has at hand. She's a national security consultant, also the co-host of the Bombshell podcast from the site War on the Rocks. Erin, good to talk to you again.
Hi, Kai.
Give me the organizational challenges that General McMaster faces here on the National Security Council, because it's a new environment for him.
It is. And so I think there's definitely two challenges, one in the White House and one in the interagency more broadly. So the National Security Advisor really has three jobs. One is to manage that interagency policy process. That's all the agencies and bureaucracies that support national security policy. Mm-hmm. The second is to manage his own staff on the NSC. And the third is to advise the president. His staff's actually in pretty decent shape. He has a few allies there already, so I think that'll be a little bit easier. But we currently have a real shortage of national security staff in the Defense Department and in the State Department. There are no undersecretaries, there are no assistant secretaries, and that's going to make it really challenging to coordinate a policy process when there physically aren't the bodies in those buildings to do that work.
Well, you don't get to be a tank commander like McMaster was, and you don't get to be a three-star without some bureaucratic savvy. But how will he relate to this new challenge that he has?
I think that's going to be really interesting. So H.R. McMaster has a pretty impressive reputation in the broader national security community. He probably fought the last famous tank battle during the Gulf War. He's got a PhD in military history. He's got a very famous book. But what he doesn't have is a lot of time in Washington, and certainly no prior time on the NSC staff itself. So he's going to have a learning curve. He's a very charismatic person. He can be kind of a polarizing person. He's often said not to suffer fools easily. That's great, unless you've been designated a fool, in which case he might not be your favorite person to work with.
Stepping back to the big picture here for a second, President Trump campaigned on and won on this idea of bringing substantive change to Washington. Do we need substantive change in the national security apparatus in this country?
That's a great question. It really depends on how happy you are with the Obama administration's foreign policy and with the broader international consensus with regard to things like our allies in NATO and also in East Asia. So there will be certainly some changes to policy, I would guess, particularly with regard to Iran, where General McMaster is fairly hawkish, as is his collaborators in the Defense Department. But I don't know if we're going to see or if we should see major revisions to policy with regard to Russia or Syria, or much less China and other parts of the globe.
He seems to be, General McMaster does, riding very high popularity-wise now. I mean, everybody who is anybody in national security is saying that this is the guy to have. What are the bumps? What are the pitfalls that he ought to be aware of?
I think you should go back and watch that tape of Secretary Mattis looking over President Trump's shoulder, signing the immigration EO in the Hall of Heroes at the Pentagon. That's an image for a lot of folks that's really hard to get out of our heads. I'm told that Secretary Mattis didn't have a lot of notice on that. That seems kind of deliberate to me, and I think he's going to have to look for a fair amount of moral courage in terms of telling truth to power, both to the president and to the interlocutors across the government, trying to make sure that we keep foreign policy and national security interests really at the heart of the matter and not to let politics come into that at all.
Which is, of course, what he wrote his book about back when he was a captain.
He sure did.
Yeah, exactly. Erin Simpson writes for the blog War on the Rocks. She also co-hosts the podcast The Bombshell there. Erin, thanks very much.
Thank you, Kai.
Brand new EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt spoke to the staff at the Environmental Protection Agency today.
I think our nation has done better than any nation in the world at making sure that we do the job of protecting our natural resources and protecting our environment while also respecting the economic growth and jobs our nation seeks to have.
Has to be said here for the record that Pruitt is a climate change denier, and he also, as the Attorney General of the state of Oklahoma, sued the EPA a dozen times or more. There has long been talk, though, among GOP lawmakers about cutting what they say are unnecessary and job-killing environmental regulations. But cutting the EPA itself is no easy task either, as Marketplace's Adam Allington reports.
Scott Pruitt's own LinkedIn bio describes him as a, quote, leading advocate against EPA's activist agenda, end quote. So not exactly a warm pat on the back from the new boss.
We live in very different times. This administration has provided a very chilling environment right off the bat.
Gretchen Goldman is research director at the Union of Concerned Scientists. She argues that the money the EPA spends on grants and contracts is only a fraction of the benefits received in communities around the country.
Lots of EPA funding goes to state-level programs, superfunds and cleanups and environmental justice communities or communities at the fence line of industrial facilities.
About half of the EPA's budget passes through state and local governments, projects like the one Mark Sulzbach oversees. He's the Clean Diesel Grants Manager for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency.
We just closed a round of applications for $400,000 in project money to reduce emissions on diesel engines.
All told, Sulzbach says the EPA grants have helped retrofit some 3,500 school buses with CO2 filters. The priority now is garbage trucks, one of the biggest sources of fleet emissions.
They're big, they're very thirsty, they go into neighborhoods.
For every dollar spent on reducing diesel emissions, Sulzbach says there's up to $13 in health benefits. Others worry that an attack on the EPA's grants might also hurt the economy. Fawn Sharp is the president of the Quinault Indian Nation, which sits on 200,000 coastal acres in Washington state.
We have thousands of jobs related to the fishing industry, the Dungeness crab industry.
Sharp says the Quinault Nation has been earning its living from fishing for millennia and relies heavily on an EPA grant for water monitoring and wetland restoration in Lake Quinault,
which is the place where our prized blueback sockeye salmon return annually.
Without that grant from the EPA, plus match runs from the tribe, Sharp says years of cooperative work rehabilitating the fishing industry might be irreversibly lost.
Any one of those component pieces, if they go away, it's unthinkable to even try to imagine how we're going to continue to do the work that we do around water quality on our reservation.
Requests for comment from the EPA were not returned, but previous statements from agency spokesmen said talk of cuts at this point is still premature. In Washington, I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
Coming up, well, everybody had their dreams about being a basketball player, football player. I always just wanted to be a coal miner.
Coal jobs are coming back. The president promised it. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 118 points today, about 0.6%, closed at 20,743. Look at that. The NASDAQ up 27 points, about 0.4%, 5865. S&P 500 up 14 points, about 0.6%, 2365 there. Kraft Heinz still dealing with the fallout from its decision to pull its bid for the Anglo-Dutch consumer products giant Unilever. It was off 1.8% today. Unilever shares up 1% in London. Mondelez, once part of Kraft, piled on 5.8%. Restaurant Brands International up 7% today. The company which owns Burger King and Tim Hortons agreed to buy Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen for $1.8 billion. Simoleons. Popeye's up 19% today. You're listening to Marketplace. If you want to get smarter about the things we talk about on this program every day,
technology, the economy, pop culture,
check out our podcast. It's called Make Me Smart. Me and Molly Wood.
We've got new episodes every week. Find us at marketplace.org/makemesmart or wherever you get your podcasts.
Follow us on Twitter for updates. I'm at Kai Rizdahl.
And I'm at Molly Wood.
You turn to Marketplace for the latest news about what's happening in the economy and how it impacts you and your community. When you donate to support our nonprofit newsroom, you can also get something a little more tangible. We've got a great lineup of donor thank you gifts right now. A shrinkflation mini tote bag, water bottles, mugs, hats, and yes, the Kai PA glasses are back, but only while supplies last, and I'm taking some of them. Contribute any amount to make a difference and pick up one of these gifts. Go to marketplace.org/donate. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We touched on trade a little bit up at the top. Nancy Marshall-Genzer and how the trade deficit numbers are calculated and how they might be calculated in the Trump administration. Right at the top of the list of countries on the president's trade hit list, of course, is China, which, in addition to, according to the president, manipulating its currency to gain unfair trade advantages, is also blamed by the White House for stealing American manufacturing jobs. In some parts of this country, though, the state of Georgia, for our purposes today, it's actually been international companies, including those from China, that have been creating domestic jobs. From WABE, LEU reports.
Scott Malone unlocks a gate at the front of a dirt path.
So we're going to go up the road a little bit. I'll follow you.
Drive to the top of that hill.
Malone heads the Economic Development Authority in LaGrange, Georgia, about an hour southwest of Atlanta. We head up to the top of a mound where the land has been cleared. Looking down, you can see out for about a mile. After the red clay is leveled out, this site will become a factory for a Chinese company called Century Tire.
Everything you see out there will be plant. And so it's a huge, huge site, no question.
And Malone says a huge win for the city. Century Tire announced last fall it would open its first U.S. manufacturing plant here, creating more than 1,000 jobs.
You see the rail? That's the rail. The rail down there on the bottom, that wraps all the way around the site. And the rail was a very important part of this project.
Important because trains will transport natural rubber directly to the site from the port of Savannah on Georgia's coast. Infrastructure. It's just one reason Malone says Georgia's been attractive to businesses abroad, not to mention all the state's other incentives, like tax breaks for creating jobs and for the purchase of manufacturing equipment. The state of Georgia recently put out this promotional video in Chinese. It shows people playing tennis, gardening, and working in Georgia. Chinese business leaders give testimonials about just how much they like living in the Peach State. There's even authentic Chinese food in Georgia, a woman explains. The video is part of Georgia's strategy to lure business from China. Pat Wilson heads the Georgia Department of Economic Development. In his 7 years there, he's been to China 16 times. He says China's a big market for the state's products.
You'd be amazed at the amount of chicken that goes to China. You know, every time I'm in China, I always make the joke that I'm probably eating Georgia chicken. And it's great.
In 2015, Georgia exported chicken and other goods, $2.6 billion worth, to China. And right now, more than 60 Chinese companies operate in Georgia. Wilson says as wages in China go up, businesses are looking to move to the U.S., closer to the market where they sell a lot of their products. All this business is why some are worried if the relationship between the U.S. and China takes a bad turn.
I think there is a possibility of a trade war with China.
Jeff Rosenzweig teaches international business at Emory University. Of course, that hasn't happened yet, but President Trump's administration has talked about across-the-board tariffs on goods from countries like Mexico and China. If something like that happens, Rosenzweig says China could then retaliate by increasing its own tariffs and by stopping the flow of investment to the U.S.
You know, we're talking about a society where the government has a lot of control over capital flows, for instance. If they say to a Chinese company, we really don't want you to take $500 million and invest it in Georgia, that company is not going to take $500 million out of China.
At the site of the new Century Tire plant, the company's North America CEO, Rami Helminen, is focused on moving ahead with construction. He's also thinking long term.
So this has enough premises to build even two factories. So after 10 years or so, then we have a possibility to expand the operation here.
Helminen says whatever happens between the U.S. and China, business would have to adapt. But he doesn't want to speculate on what might happen if trade relations get really bad. Construction on the tire plant is slated to start early next year. In LaGrange, Georgia, I'm Ellie Yu for Marketplace.
All right, so here's the flip side of Ellie's story. More on the promises the president made during his campaign about bringing jobs back to this economy. Now that this is Donald Trump's economy, maybe no place in the country is holding tighter to those promises than West Virginia coal country, where more than 26,000 mining jobs were lost between 2011 and 2015. We've been doing a series for the past year or so with Frontline and PBS NewsHour called How the Deck is Stacked, about exactly that phenomenon, how Americans in different parts of the country are experiencing their own economies. Frontline has done a series of short documentaries called Betting on Trump, again, about the promises he made during the campaign. And we're going to play an audio version of one of those stories right now. It's the different perspectives of two West Virginia coal miners. One's retired and one is just starting out.
I've been a registered Democrat all my life, but I crossed over this year. I voted for Donald Trump. He promised to help the coal miners. And for this region, we need help.
I really want to be a coal miner. Always have been, ever since I was in high school. Everybody had their dreams about being a basketball player, a football player. I always just wanted to be a coal miner.
There's good men out here just walking the streets. Their families are getting desperate. Welfare can't keep people forever. These men need to go back to work.
They said that things went dry. It made it really, really hard to take care of a baby and a wife. The only thing that I really give them thought about is Trump getting in office and going back to work.
Coal mining's a rough job. I was very seldom off. I worked 6 days a week and sometimes seven. I worked 16 hours a day instead of eight.
I guess I basically seek it because it's hard work. I've always been a fan of hard work. It's the way I was brought up. Family man, I guess.
When I first went into mines in 1969, the risk factor of black lung diseases wasn't mentioned a whole lot. I was one of them young coal miners. I'd never get it.
Coal mining, I don't think it's that risky. My family's done it for generations. I think it's well worth it. I've always liked the thrill, adrenaline rush. When things get a little bit hairy, you know, I love being in those situations. You know, there's risk in everything you take.
I thought I was 10 foot tall and bulletproof. It didn't take long for me to realize I wasn't. The doctor told me, he said, you've contacted it. Now you need to do something about it. But buying a home, 92 automobiles. I had my daughter in school. You couldn't go out and just quit work and go hunt a job somewhere in another field that you wasn't even trained for. So you just had to keep working. You had to keep going until one day you realize, hey, I done went too far.
Callie, she's 4 days old. She's just born on Friday. Colton, he'll be 2 in February. My American dream would just be to watch my kids grow up happy and healthy. That's the only thing I could ever ask for.
Our new administration is talking about repealing Obamacare and realizing a lot of coal mines are shut down, but taking a man's benefits shouldn't be part of that. When they take that away, they're taking your livelihood away.
If it picks up and it starts booming, that's probably all I'll do for the rest of my life. Be a coal miner, support my family, make good money, you know, have something in life.
If I could give any advice to any young miner right now, I'd say run. Find you another occupation. When you see a coal mine, turn around and go the other way. Just go.
That was 69-year-old Dave Bounds, 20-year-old Dakota Hall. Characters in one of a bunch of Frontline's Betting on Trump documentaries. There is a link to them at our website. It's marketplace.org. All right, this final note on the way out today, a quickie that'll appeal to the historians among you. On this date 45 years ago, anybody? Richard Nixon landed in Beijing. Nixon goes to China. Funny how history turns out, huh? All right, we got to go. The Dow up 118 points today, about 0.6%. The Nasdaq up 27 points, 0.4%. S&P 500 up 14 points, 0.6% there. Tommy Andres and Raghu Manavalan are the producers on our special projects desk. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. Our digital team includes Ben Hethcote, Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Khreis, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.